You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Inez Tan. Inez, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Brainerd.
Inez, let's talk about what you're working on now. I know there's your wonderful book, This Is Where I Won't Be Alone, which is short stories and some poetry we're also going to talk about during this, but what's occupying you at the moment?
Sure. So with regards to the fiction, you're right. My first book, a collection of short stories called This Is Where I Won't Be Alone, was published in Singapore last September. And kind of excitingly, the ebook just launched just a couple of weeks ago. So been trying to get the word out about that, writing a couple of little short essays about it and so on, thinking about some of the same questions that I was thinking about as I wrote that book, having to do with home, having to do with belonging, where a sense of belonging comes from, and how we think about home, if home can mean so many different places and different things to different people. I'm working on a book of poems right now. I am currently an MFA graduate student in poetry writing at the University of California, Irvine. This is my third and last year. So wrapping up that manuscript, trying to pull together this first book of poems and sending some of those poems out right now. I was really excited to have one of the long poems in there published in Hyphen Magazine back in the fall. And yeah, that's been exciting. And lastly, just thinking about teaching a lot, I think of myself as kind of a writer, you know, fiction writer, poet writer, poetry, and teaching kind of all at once. I really think that being able to move between those kinds of writing and teaching and helping people write really helps me. I think it brings a lot of energy to each of those. So teaching right now, sort of introductory writing courses at UCI, and been really happy thinking about that.
So that's exciting, and it's exciting that you're about to graduate and thinking about all these things. The book, This Is Where I Won't Be Alone, Stories, was a national bestseller in Singapore. So as a student, that seems like a pretty remarkable achievement, but I also want to ask you, why was it published in Singapore, and how did that come about? Because that seems very unusual in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, happy to talk about that. So kind of the journey of that book, I grew up in Singapore, age 7 through 15, and my parents are from there, my whole extended family is there, even though I myself was born in the U.S. and have kind of lived in both places my whole life, been in the U.S. the last 10 years, particularly at one stretch. And as I was writing, Flannery O'Connor is one of my favorite writers, and something she said once is, the writer's imagination is not free, but bound. And that has really stuck with me. The imagination is not free, but bound. And what she means by that is there's only so much any of us can invent. To some degree, you need to really know whatever it is you're writing about, whatever you're imagining. And for a lot of us, that has to do with our own personal lived experience. I totally believe that as a fiction writer, you can go beyond that. That's one of my favorite things about fiction and poetry and any kind of writing is that you can try to imagine an experience that you yourself haven't lived through directly. But for me, I found I was writing stories more and more about Singapore, where I had grown up. And something that I realized as I was writing these stories and trying to set them in Singapore was firstly that I had not grown up with a lot of stories set in Singapore. Singapore is a pretty young country, and while we speak English in school, it's one of the national languages. It's been spoken in Singapore for some time. Literature in English has not really been around quite as long. I would say poetry back maybe the last 50 years, but fiction not that much until maybe the last 10 or 15 years, just kind of broad strokes. And I thought, how strange. It's so strange that when my friends and I were growing up in Singapore, we didn't read stories about growing up in Singapore. We've read British stories, we read American stories, you know, we loved Harry Potter, we loved Lord of the Rings, we loved kind of the classic books of British and American literature. And I think that sort of contributed to my understanding that fiction could be about something completely imagined. But it did leave me with this yearning eventually for fiction about something that was real, something that, you know, reflected the experiences of people I knew, you know, family members, friends, and so on. And as that started to find its way into the book I was writing, which also, oddly enough, was mostly written in rural Massachusetts and Ann Arbor, Michigan, which were the places I was living at the time, while kind of recalling, you know, Singapore and my family and life there, it felt very important to me that I try to publish this book in Singapore. So it was very happily accepted by Epigram Books, which is a pretty young publisher, really, about the last 10 years. By U.S. standards, it would be a small press, but in Singapore, it is, I would say, probably the largest, I would say the largest fiction publisher, but one of a few publishers who are, I think, really kind of having a vision for local reads and the stories of the people of Singapore, you know, to be kind of broad about it. So it's an exciting time with publishing in Singapore. Lots of fiction, poetry, nonfiction getting published, some for the first time. Many people very young being published and read, and thus getting to be in dialogue, you know, with older writers. So it's been exciting. I feel really, really lucky that the book was there, that it's been doing well. And I think kind of most gratifying to me is hearing from people, you know, some people I didn't know at all, saying that they felt touched by something they read. Something I was trying really hard to get at with this book was home means something so different for those of us who have lived in Singapore. Many people who grew up there spend some time abroad, whether that's, you know, in their college years or for work or travel. And even the Singapore that our parents lived in is very different from the place we lived in, because the country changes really quickly. You know, the buildings change, the way we speak changes, change happens very, very quickly. So with all that, I think there can be kind of a narrative that that this is home. You know, this is, we all feel the same way. And on the other hand, realizing that every person's conception of home is a little bit different. And I wanted to sort of to speak to that understanding of home, which I felt was in its own way kind of Singaporean.
Right, and also you lived in multiple cities throughout the United States, so that, of course, also mm-hmm. affects your idea of home, right? Eight cities mm-hmm. you've lived in, right? So that's also, mm-hmm. I would imagine, affects the sense of what home means.
Absolutely.
So let's hear from this. You're going to read from the book first?
That's right.
So tell me a little bit about what you're going to read, and then, I mean, you don't have to say much about it, but if you want to just say the title of what it is, and then read it.
Sure. Absolutely. So I will read the shortest story from the book. I usually like, when I pick up a collection, I like to start with the shortest story. So taste of my own medicine. But the story is called Home, and just for sort of for listeners, it's set in a McDonald's at a place called King Albert Park, which is just kind of a neighborhood. And just to give a little bit of context, it was a McDonald's that had been there for a long time and near a number of schools. So if you were, you know, a child or a teenager in this area going to school, this McDonald's was like a staple. Like, you went there, you know, often, you know, if you got half a day off from school, or if you just had a little, you know, if you wanted to study with air conditioning. So it was a real landmark, and I was surprised that I felt really upset the day it was torn down to make way for condominiums. So I'll read from the story called Home. I never went inside the McDonald's at King Albert Park, except as a child. Happy Meal in hand, I'd see groups of secondary school and junior college students in their school uniforms, silently studying, their books and files all spread out across the shiny colored tables. They seemed full of purpose, which is almost the same as being full of contentment. They were impossibly older than I was then, and impossibly younger than I am now. Unlike them, I never felt like the place belonged to me, but that doesn't stop me from missing it now that it's gone. I dreamed about kissing you just once. You were sitting in a booth in that very same McDonald's, talking to me, though I couldn't hear the words. I kissed you, and you kissed me back, and just like that, the dream ended. We'd split up a week ago. The construction site had already stood on that corner for years. I don't know why every landmark McDonald's is disappearing. If anything, I eat there much more often now that I go by myself. Where does a sense of belonging come from? A place? Who you were there and who you were with? All the people I love and leave holes in my body, empty sites. You were the one who told me that home is something we have to make for ourselves. I picture myself looking into old buildings that aren't there anymore. I can see us inside. A place we never were, as easy to imagine as a place we'll never be. That was home.
Well, thank you, Inez. That's beautiful and so interesting because, you know, McDonald's is a place where it sounds like it would be the least homey, and that's what makes that, I think, such an exciting story, as well as, you know, the kind of age you were, the fantasy of a kiss that's really lovely. And so I want to talk more about poetry, but just to focus a little more on this story. Mm-hmm. Is this a story that you've read before when you do readings? I think you were saying that earlier, right?
Yeah. I've read this one a few times just because it's so short, and it can be hard to listen to a long story, I think. I find it hard sometimes to keep track of something that you're just listening to. So I like it for its brevity. I also like it for its, you know, it's so on the nose. It just asks, what is home? And I remember I wrote it. It came together from a couple of things. There was that question of what is home, and this realization that home was not just a place, but it was people. And that you were a different person depending on the people you were with. Later on, years after I wrote it, I read about sort of third culture kids, and it was a term I'd heard much later in life, long after I grew up. I really wish I'd had it growing up because it was such a fascinating concept to me, this idea that children who grow up somewhere that is different from their parents' culture, they have three cultures. They have their parents, they have the one they grow up in, and they have something called the third culture, which is their very own hybrid of the other cultures that they're straddling. And the sort of most amazing insight is that third culture kids have a lot in common with one another. The third culture is a sort of a commonality. So, you know, someone who is Chinese but grew up in Sweden has a lot in common with someone who is French and grew up in Zimbabwe, for example. There's something about this idea of growing up third culture where you were putting together your parents and the culture that you had been born into and lived in that gives these people a lot in common. And one of those primary things is they don't think of home as a place, they think of it as people. So that's sort of some of the thinking that went into that story.
Thank you for that. And tell me a little bit about the poem you're going to read now. I know that you said you were working on poems and have done so before. What is the poem you're going to read now?
Sure. I'll read a poem called Apology for Bread. And these books are, these poems are from a book I'm working on called Consummation. And you can already hear in that title, it's been very concerned with things growing and reaching fulfillment, reaching some kind of union, something that's often transformative. At the same time, I think it wants to recognize how difficult that can be, that process of becoming something that you were meant to become or wanting to transform into, and the many tensions sort of on the way to that. So I'll read this poem called Apology for Bread that I think holds in tension sort of the individual and the community and the relationship between those two, especially when they're at odds. Apology for Bread. On this day, like every other, we need bread. This loaf before me, the least of its kind, was not made to feel ashamed by the hands that arranged it gently facing outwards with the others, snug and proud on the supermarket shelf. Last week, someone loaded bread onto a delivery truck, and someone will drive the plastic wrappers to a garbage dump afterwards. Someone is weatherproofing a house for refugees in the suburbs. Someone is serving drinks on a plane. And someone is holding a protest in the terminal where people have been detained for 9 hours without food or water. Bread. Even in a child's hands, this load is nearly weightless. Nothing but flour and empty pockets. The legacy of less than a gram of yeast, though not too little to matter. Everything it touches will rise. And that was Apology for Bread.
Thank you. That was beautiful. And what is that? Is it from a published collection, or is that something you're working on now?
That's pretty much done. It's going into the collection. It was published in a literary journal online called The Collagist, which I love a lot, and it was an honor. This one's pretty much done.
And so that's exciting. I mean, I didn't think it wasn't done, but just wondering where that was going into. You say you're a student and you're pursuing your MFA in poetry, but just to be clear for everyone listening, you already have an MFA in fiction, and this is your second master's degree you're pursuing, correct?
That's right. That's my second MFA. Couldn't get enough.
Right. That's pretty ambitious. So to talk about that a little bit, obviously you want to keep writing, and so you had an MFA in fiction. Maybe it seems straightforward as to why, but I feel like I should ask anyway. So why another MFA in poetry?
Sure. It took me a while to figure out myself, so I don't think it's as straightforward as anything. But I guess I could say I started out always writing fiction and poetry together. And when I went for my MFA in fiction, I thought, all right, that's it, just fiction from now on. You know, turn off the tap, shut everything else down, let's focus here. And I realized a couple of things. I realized, firstly, that some things were better as poems and some were better as fiction. I had a lot of stories I had to just junk because they just weren't happening. But as soon as I tried to write them as poems, something came alive in them, or they seemed much better suited to something in poetry. To me, I think the advantage of fiction is being able to tell a story, being able to have a narrative with, you know, a before and after, an arc, characters. And in poetry, I think I love poems for this intimate space they create, the sense that you have a voice directly talking to you and nobody else, and telling you something in secret almost. There's a Walt Whitman line I really love. I may not tell everyone, but I will tell you. And I love that. I think of that as poetry. You know, I won't tell everyone, but I will tell you. So realizing that and realizing how much I missed poetry made me want to get back into writing poetry. And when I do, I think that helps me at both. You know, I think fiction helps you be attentive to stories and action and drama, and poetry helps you be very attentive to language, just individual words, the way a sentence is balanced, the way the cadences of a stanza affect the way you experience it as a listener or reader. An analogy I sometimes give to my students when I'm teaching is, you know, imagine that fiction is this huge oak tree and poetry is this little bonsai tree. You know, they're kind of doing the same thing. They're both trees, but you can make a teeny tiny change on a bonsai and notice it immediately. You totally notice the way it changes that. Whereas with a whole tree, you're working on a completely different scale and the things you're trying to do are different. So I think of them as really complementary, and I've just been happy to get to write poems, you know, while I was editing, really. This is where I won't be alone.
Thank you. Yeah, that's clear. I'm glad I asked that. So what are you going to read now? There's one more poem. Is this from a collection or something that's been published before?
Yeah, so this is, sometimes individual poems get published before a whole manuscript of poems. That's pretty common, I think, and just kind of a good way to get your poems out there. So this has also been published. This is in the poetry magazine Rattle, and this is also in the manuscript I'm working on with the poems. This poem is titled Laurel, and just as a little bit of a preface, I think I was thinking about trees, and I was thinking of the story of Apollo and Daphne, where you know, to get away from this god who was, you know, trying to seduce her, she so much didn't want to be with him that she asked to be turned into a tree, and her wish was granted. And I thought that was just wonderful. You know, when you don't want to be in a messy human relationship, why not be a tree instead? So that was some of that. And I'll read this poem. This is called Laurel. A tree is not anyone's ward, not anyone's burden, not anyone's future wife. If someone looked at a tree with lust, most of us would find that disturbing. If someone rubbed up against a tree, most of us would try to get that person help. No tree is told it can't sit at another tree's table. No tree is enthralled to a meritocracy. No tree lays a hand on another tree's neck. Trees don't actually have particular preferences for anyone. Trees think the same of one another in and out of their clothes. Safe in themselves, as themselves, they are better off not touching or obstructing each other's light. The woods are as glorious as the tree that stands alone. That was Laurel.
Thank you so much, Inez. Thank you. Really lovely, and such a great image. It's so true. That is a great way of sidestepping so much to become a tree instead of dealing with all that we have to deal with as humans. You know? because the poem reflects on that, it does make me think how wonderful and odd an escape that is, you know.
And I hope some of the language, you know, some of the tree language versus some of the people language was helping to bring that idea to mind. Trees think the same of one another in and out of their clothes. I hope that sort of made the idea of how strange it is that humans think so differently of one another in and out of their clothes. I love when poems can use the language itself to suggest, you know, one thing we think about one way can be very different if we just think about it in another way or through this metaphor.
Yeah, I love that too. So let me ask you one more question before we go. I'm always curious what everyone's reading. What are you reading at the moment?
Sure. I am reading some poetry and some fiction. I'm reading Ada Limón's new book, The Carrying, one of my favorite poets, and The Carrying is so good. I've flagged almost every page in it so far. Her language is so immediate and so vulnerable, and she writes just kind of fearlessly about death and living and trying to become a mother and horses. She loves horses, so always a great read. And for fiction, I'm reading a novel called The Garden of Evening Mists by this Malaysian writer named Tan Tuan Eng. And it's an extraordinary book so far. Kind of, if just to go really briefly into it, a Malaysian judge who had lived through the Japanese occupation and kind of really suffered, you know, through the Japanese occupation of her country and lost her very beloved sister. When the story begins, she's tracking down this Japanese gardener who lived in rural Malaysia because it had been her sister's kind of dying wish to have a Japanese garden, and it had been the thing that sustained the two of them while they were really suffering and struggling to survive during the war. The other thing, though, is that the judge is beginning to, she's quite old at this point, and she's very rapidly losing her memory. So it comes as she's trying to write down and preserve her memories, even though she'd really rather not confront them, but she doesn't want to lose them either. So much happening in the Garden of Evening Mists.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I actually read that book, and it's also a very, very beautiful, very beautiful book.
Yeah.
I'm glad you mentioned that one and gave a synopsis of it, because it's so, especially her, you know, kind of losing her memory and trying to write about that is such a strange and odd and wonderful thing to try to capture as a writer.
Yeah, and the tension between, I think the beauty and the suffering that taught her to value the beauty, but that also helped her endure it. I think those can be very grand concepts, but seeing them really in this woman's story has been very compelling so far. So I will someday find out how it ends. I'm glad you've read it too.
Inez, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today. It's been a pleasure, and I wish you great success with your next book and finishing your degree.
Thank you so much, Brainerd. It was a real joy talking to you this afternoon.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.